While other international leaders at Davos 2026 called out the US President Donald Trump for bullying that's unacceptable, Germany's Friedrich Merz chose his words carefully. His criticism was subtle, focused on what Europe needs to do rather than condemning how Trump is behaving. And there's a simple reason: Germany can't afford to ruffle too many feathers in Washington right now. It's too dependent. But what does that mean specifically? Today, we'll give you a full Berlin briefing on Germany's dependencies on the US. And I'll do that with my two guests, William Ahlberg, Senior Adjunct Fellow with the Pacific Forum. Thank you very much for joining us here in our little studio. And over on the line, DW's Washington Bureau Chief, Ines Pohl. Hi, Ines. Good to see you there. And we'll also try and show the cards that Germany holds, because there are a couple still that Germany could play a bit more proactively, right? So, William, you did work at NATO for a couple of years. You were in Brussels. Did you ever think that we would ever reach a situation where we would, in all earnestness, all seriousness, discuss the possibility of one NATO ally as big as the US invading another ally?
Well, I have to say, part of my time there, I was there from 2012 to 2020. So I was there for the first Trump administration. And the bigger fear was that Trump was going to withdraw from NATO. He had said that out loud. And one of the things about when he came back for the second term was he was going to settle scores. And so, you know, a lot of us thought that that was part of the unfinished business. And looking at the situation with Greenland, it was hard not to look at that as potentially Trump trying to force the issue, trying to force, because if he did take Greenland by force, it would be the end of NATO. And so maybe this was sort of a passive way, because he knew that if he just told Congress he was going to withdraw, they would, even the Republicans would slow him down or stop him. So this was probably a backdoor way of doing it. And so, you know, with at least the temporary news of the prevention of that happening, that's very good news. But there have been conflicts between NATO allies before. There was the fisheries war, where allies did shoot at each other. There was Greece versus Turkey over Cyprus, and that was a brutal war of conquest, you know, between NATO allies that caused a huge rift, but managed to, NATO managed to survive that. So on the one hand, I did expect strange things to happen with NATO during this term. Never over Greenland. That was a real surprise. But unfortunately, we are just in this era of complete uncertainty with where the U.S. is going. And so we have to continue to watch it really carefully. And it's an important game of diplomacy that's happening right now.
And Ines, I want to ask you, do you think Americans get a sense of just how astonished we here in Europe and in Germany are when we watch Donald Trump on the stage in Switzerland, in Davos? He does seem to be increasingly erratic. There is an element to it where people are beginning to speak of dementia. Is that something where the US audience is aware just how it's going down in Germany?
The problem with the US audience really is whom you ask in the United States. Those, of course, who are following world news, those of the Americans who have an understanding how important the transatlantic relationship is also for their own country, they are, of course, shocked, or were shocked when he started talking about using military force to take over Greenland. But there is also a large amount of Americans, and these groups are actually growing. They just don't follow the news anymore. They're so tired. They're so overwhelmed. And this whole Steve Bannon ideas of, you know, flooding the zone is really working. There are news every single second. It feels like that. Every morning you wake up to another major shift. And what I find interesting, and I think Donald Trump kind of misinterpreted the success with Venezuela. Many Americans applauded him kidnapping Maduro. Because he's like a terrible leader, and people here, many Americans know that or knew that. And I think Donald Trump was a little bit taken away by this reaction of his people from both sides of the political angle, and thought, okay, and now I can move on with, as William said, pushing Europeans even further regarding his own ambitions when it comes to NATO. So I think that was his mistake. But the short answer is, it's not like an outcry here in the United States that people say, stop playing around with Greenland, as it is in Europe.
And the outcry, as you just called it, doesn't just come from ordinary citizens, ordinary people, who, of course, are talking about Donald Trump a lot over dinner at home in their houses. It also comes out, you know, in the statements given by international leaders in Davos in Switzerland, reacting to the behavior of the Trump administration. And I just want us all to be on the same page. So I'll just do a quick recap where we are, because things are moving so fast. So we're recording this as the World Economic Forum in Davos is still happening. Right. International diplomacy is a whirlwind. And Donald Trump had, of course, said for a long time that he says he wants Greenland and says it's important for security in the Arctic. Then last weekend, a couple of European countries said, OK, we'll send a couple of people there, RICON mission, essentially, to look at ways how to enhance security in the Arctic. Donald Trump sees this and interprets it the wrong way, apparently, and threatens these countries with tariffs. Italy's Meloni then says it's all a big misunderstanding. It was never a mission to defend Greenland against a US attack, but Trump insists on his tariff threat, hints at consequences. Then there were lots of emergency meetings and conversations between European leaders. Eventually, the EU then said, OK, enough is enough. We can't have those tariffs. If you apply those tariffs, then we'll think about using one of our bigger swords, which is elements like the anti-coercion instrument. So a lot of conflict potentially in the air. So everybody was watching very, very closely and, you know, with halted breath to see what Donald Trump would say in Switzerland. Then eventually he took to the stage and said he wouldn't use force on Greenland. Let's just listen to that moment in his speech.
We never asked for anything and we never got anything. We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. Okay? Now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made, because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
So, William, what does that mean?
Well, there's a lot of speculation today that the market moves over the past few days, sharp sell-off in U.S. assets, real concern because Europe holds so many financial instruments that are vital to U.S. health. If Europe sort of divest itself, interest rates would spike. And interest rates are a huge concern of Donald Trump and would do severe damage in the run-up to really critical midterm elections coming up in the United States. That may have been part of what moved him. I do think Meloni is right. I think part of what the Europeans did was being portrayed by other Europeans as being, you know, a defiance to the United States. NATO is actually perfectly poised to do an Arctic mission if is required, if they want additional air policing, which looks like it will be part of it. If you want a new vigilance mission, so NATO has set itself up to do really quick deployments when necessary for security. You saw this happen in Lithuania. We saw this happen a couple times in Europe over the past year. So if that's what they need, if this is really a security concern, I would say that over the decades, NATO has not done enough in terms of Arctic security. Part of that was because Norway and Canada didn't want allies involved. There was the Arctic Council. But now that Russia and China are being so disruptive, it makes sense. But if there's a security concern, there's the 1951 treaty between the United States and Denmark, which allows the United States to increase its basing without necessarily having to go through Parliament or any other means through Denmark. We used to have about
10,000
troops
there. Doesn't need to own it to do these
things. And in fact, does the U.S. really want to own it? There are 57,000 people who live in Greenland who have free health care, who have free education, who have all these wonderful benefits. Is the United States going to own that and therefore take away those benefits and give them the same lesser benefits the United States has? Also, Greenland actually takes more money from Denmark than, you know, it's a net absorber of taxes. Is the United States going to take this burden on? Is Trump really going to explain to the population that we now have 57,000 more people that we have to take care of? It always seemed strange. I think the real issue, the real security issue, if there is one, is about the fact that the Arctic is becoming more contested, that Russia and China are pushing in. It's also missile defense. The United States used to have a lot of NORAD assets, a lot of the North American air defense system in Greenland. There was also the communication line for nuclear early warning. So I get that. But if the United States wants extended, you know, sovereignty over its bases there, that's a matter for a SOFA agreement, a status of forces agreement between the US and Denmark, which can be easily negotiated. And it looks more like that's what has happened, is Trump sort of spirals on his own. He gets fed by really bad advisors who get him saying really strange things. Then when he sits down with the Europeans face to face and they say, what do you need? Do you want more NATO troops taking care of patrolling? We can help in these sectors. US can help in these sectors. You want more basing in Greenland? Fantastic. We'll help. We used to have nuclear weapons in Canada as part of our air defense system. There's nothing we can't negotiate with allies. But I do think one of the things that this illustrates to me is that the European leaders should really develop a rota where they come to Washington on a regular basis and make sure that he's hearing from these folks so that he doesn't get into his little echo chamber. And
they're the last ones in the room because famously he seems to listen to the last person.
He really does. And I do think he takes heads of state very seriously. I think even though he thinks, you know, he's got the greatest country in the world, having Maloney, having Meretz, having that head of state come and talk to him shows him the needed respect that he feels like he deserves in order to then really have talks and say, oh, wait a second, if that's really what you want, we can solve that. Let's solve that together.
And there are several issues at play here, of course, because international leaders, the Canadian Prime Minister, as much as European leaders, they agree with Donald Trump in the substance that security in the Arctic needs to be enhanced. They thank Donald Trump for having essentially awakened the Europeans who kept hitting the snooze button when it came to defense spending. So without Donald Trump, many of them said they would never have agreed to those 5% of GDP defense spending. Okay, having said all that, it's now a question of who reacts in which style and why. We want to focus on how Germany's reacting, but first we need to see how others are reacting to then have a comparison. So most striking in terms of the confidence that he exerted was Canadian Premier Mark Carney. Let's hear what he said.
It seems that every day we're reminded that we live in an era of great power rivalry, that the rules-based order is fading, that the strong can do what they can and the weak must suffer what they must. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Over the past two decades, a series of crises in finance, health, energy, and geopolitics have laid bare the risks of extreme global integration. But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited.
He doesn't name Donald Trump, but we all know he was talking about him. Let's listen to the Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever.
Until now, we tried to appease the new president in the White House. We were very lenient also with the tariffs. We were lenient, hoping to get his support for the Ukraine war. Well, we are in a very bad position at the moment. We're dependent on the United States, so we chose to be lenient. But now so many red lines are being crossed that you have the choice between your self-respect. Being a happy vassal is one thing. Being a miserable slave is something else. If you back down now, you're going to lose your dignity. And that's probably the most precious thing you can have in a democracy. It's your dignity. So we should unite.
And I want to bring this, I want to bring Ines back in Washington. Where does Germany position itself there, Ines? I mean, these are very strong words. How difficult is it for Germany not to use such language?
Yeah, I don't know if you will play Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor's response as well in this show. That's interesting. He's walking a kind of a a slippery slope here, because he knows that Germany is highly dependent, still is highly dependent on the United States when it comes to defense. And Merz, of course, also knows that the war in Ukraine is still going on. Nobody's, or hardly anybody, is still talking about it. But this is, of course, a huge issue for Germany. And Germany also knows if Donald Trump would stop supporting Ukraine, or at least selling weapons to Ukraine, it would be a huge problem, not only for Ukraine, but also for Europe, because that would then basically mean that Vladimir Putin might win this war. So what I'm saying, Friedrich Merz is much more careful in what he says. And it is interesting for me, because I'm also a White House pooler here, so I am in the Oval Office regularly. I was there when Friedrich Merz and Donald Trump met, and Donald Trump has some respect for Friedrich Merz, and I think Friedrich Merz doesn't want to spoil that. So he walks a careful line, but he knows how important Germany and the German market is for Donald Trump. And he said some weeks ago, he was pretty harsh in criticizing Donald Trump, much harsher than he was before. But at this very moment, he's a little bit more careful. If I might, I would like to pick up on something William said earlier on about the markets reacting to Donald Trump's threats with Greenland. I mean, the Dow Jones went down 800 points. And this is something the American people realize, you know. And honestly, I think this was the main reason why Donald Trump backed down here, because he can't afford that the prices will get even higher here. And this will be the most important issue when it comes to these midterms in November this year. So he was reacting to the market reactions, and he's watching that very closely. And so are his advisors. And I think this is where, like, Europe's power really comes in. If Europe plays this card, then they have leverage over Trump and his supporters. There is no, like, romantic, you know, transatlantic, it's important, we love each other, we went through so much together. This is done, this is over. And honestly, I think this will never come back, regardless who will be sitting in the White House in 3 years. But the economic kind of impact Europe can have to the American market, this is a card Europe and Germany really can play.
So let's listen to Friedrich Merz's reaction.
The international order of the past three decades, anchored in international law, has always been imperfect. Today, its very foundations have been shaken. This new world of great powers is being built on power, on strength, and when it comes to it, on force. It's not a cozy place. We do not have to accept this new reality as fate. We are not at the mercy of this new world order. We do have a choice. We can shape the future. To succeed, we must face harsh realities and chart our course with clear-eyed realism.
Okay, so a very different tone there. And I now want to get to that bit that I announced at the top of this episode, that we'll try and unpack the why behind this tone. So Germany's reliance on those many fields in security, in nuclear deterrence, tech, intelligence, defense procurement, energy, and the exposure to tariffs from the US. And William, since you're here and you're an expert, let's look at that nuclear deterrence factor. Let's just imagine, just to make it very clear for people to understand, if there was a threat, say from the East, on Germany, and we would know that there was somebody who was about to fire a rocket towards Berlin, what would happen? How would Germany be protected?
Well, right now, Germany would be protected by U.S. missile defense, the NATO missile defense shield, which has limited capabilities, but does have capability against the scenario that you're talking about. You know, it was designed to defend against a rocket from a country like Iran or North Korea. So Germany would be wholly dependent on the U.S. assets and the NATO assets in that regard.
What's that mean?
It means
how many planes do we have that could react, for example? You know, how many soldiers are in Germany that belong to the US that are actually, you know, also ready to intercept missiles that are coming, flying in towards Germany?
Global business isn't just charts and suits.
It's a messy, unpredictable soap opera set on a global stage.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Cassandra.
If you think the economy is boring, you've been watching the wrong show.
In our weekly podcast, The Dip, we'll help you connect the dots.
That's DW's The Dip, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, to intercept a missile that was coming towards Germany, you would need radars that are outside of Germany, and you'd want interceptors that are outside of Germany as well to be able to intercept it before it hit. So you'd want to hit it in the boost phase or when it's in the atmosphere. So,
would Germany know that a missile was on its way without the Americans?
Well, and that's a big question. Does Germany have enough space assets to be able to detect missiles coming towards Germany? And the answer is, by itself, absolutely not. If it happens to be looking for that at the right time, then yes, there are enough German ISR assets, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets that it could spot something if it were looking for it specifically and if it had tasked the satellites. But the United States is the only country on Earth that has the global ability to detect a launch of a ballistic missile anywhere and to track it. And so Germany and NATO writ large is dependent on the United States. NATO itself is investing a lot of money in space assets so that it has its own additional view. Germany is investing in its own space, but it's always going to be a fraction of what the United States has. If you look at the number of launches per year, the United States far outstrips all the other countries in the world. And in addition, the commercial sector. So there are possibilities to knit together a European, a NATO, an EU, and commercial capabilities to be able to detect more. But as of today, Germany is almost wholly dependent on the United States to be able to detect incoming missiles from, say, the Far East or from the Middle East towards Germany. And the interception, well, this is why Germany announced the Sky Shield initiative, to try to purchase assets so that it also has independent German-owned or coalition-owned assets to be able to intercept incoming missiles. But that's still years away from deployment. As of right now, it would be dependent on the United States wholly for detection and interception.
Plus, 2 weeks ago in an episode here, we discussed that Germany is not allowed to have nuclear weapons itself.
Correct.
However, here in Germany, we've got Büchel, where there are nuclear bombs who are owned by the Americans, but there is this element. If you could talk to us about the treaty between the Americans and the Germans when it comes to the nuclear bombs that are in Germany, but not to be used by German soldiers.
Right. So if you go back to the Cold War, so the United States and the NATO allies realized, especially after the Korean War, that we simply didn't have the troops to be able to stop a Soviet invasion. The Soviets had 3 to 4 times as many troops, 4 to 5 times as many tanks as the entire NATO alliance. And so if the Soviets decided to roll over Europe, they could. And so the thought was, in order to stop them, you would need nuclear weapons. So starting in 1954, the US starts negotiating bilateral agreements with different allies to station nuclear weapons in Europe, number one, and number two, to then work with the European nations to be able to deliver those nuclear weapons. Because, for instance, one of the main ways to stop the Soviet army would have been landmines, nuclear landmines, and nuclear artillery. Now, you don't want to have U.S. artillery units everywhere. You just can't. There was a sector that was defended by the Dutch. There's one defended by the French. There's one defended by the Belgians. So for every ally that was in West Germany, the U.S. would then negotiate with them to be able to deliver nuclear artillery, landmines, rockets, and air-dropped bombs. So for instance, up until 1962, the French had an air wing at a West German base with U.S. nuclear bombs on it. When they left the military command, they turned that over to the Canadians, so the Canadians had them. But there were seven different allies with bilateral agreements with the United States, both to store nuclear weapons on their territory, but also to store nuclear weapons on West German territory for use against the Soviet Union in case of war. Now, at the end of the Cold War, most of those weapons went away. The idea of nuclear artillery just completely disappeared from war fighting. And with the United States and with NATO, it reduced down and down and down and down until we only have nuclear airdropped bombs. So bombs that are dropped by the F-16, the Tornado, the F-35A, F-15E, but that's not shared. So a very limited number of planes are certified to drop these bombs.
And certified by the U.S. government, right?
Certified, yes, certified by the U.S. And certification really means, you know, you have extra command and control systems that are integrated with the U.S. nuclear system in order to be able to target and drop nuclear weapons. So when the President of the United States makes the decision to go to nuclear war and the NATO allies agree on targeting, then the German forces, Air Force, is tasked to drop a nuclear weapon on targets as agreed at NATO. Now, that agreement is also bilateral
using
with Germany.
Using the German planes, but with Germany American bombs. Right.
So at Buchel Air Base, the Tornado gets loaded with a B-61 or two B-61s, and it takes off, and it's escorted by NATO aircraft, conventional, and other nuclear aircraft, and it goes and it flies its mission and drops a bomb, piloted by a German pilot. But the bombs remain under control of the United States until such time as is released for that pilot. So Germany can never just decide, we're going to use those nuclear weapons. We want to use them here. No, it would have to be a U.S. decision by the President of the United States to arm that nuclear weapon for that mission. So it's a very limited condition. And only in nuclear war, only when war goes nuclear, is that released to the German pilot. And even then, the rest of the bombs at that airbase are still under American control and will be doled out as deemed by the commander of U.S. Forces Europe, U.S. EUCOM commander, European command, who is also SHAPE, the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, SACEUR. That is the same person, the commander of U.S. forces in Europe and the commander of all NATO forces. So it makes it very easy in terms of command and control for the decision on nuclear weapons, how it's used, and you know, the NATO allies involved in terms of targeting, except for France, which does not engage in nuclear planning at NATO.
Mm-hmm. That is a great overview that you've given us. And maybe to just add to the picture, at the moment, Germany is flying the Tornados, correct, but it's phasing them out by 2030. And it's already bought 35 F-35As, which have got this certificate, essentially, right, that they can carry the bombs, just like the Tornado can at the moment. Right. But the Eurofighter, for example, that Germany uses, doesn't have that certificate yet. Right. So this is still, Germany is still going to be dependent, even with its new fleet of planes that it's using. It would need a special process to get certification to carry those nuclear bombs as well. So that's probably not going to happen.
It could, in theory.
Maybe, you know, because now the pressure is on. Maybe it will speed up negotiations as well. But is there any way, because now the German government is looking at, you know, ways to potentially speak to European neighbour France or the UK, the other two countries that are big nuclear powers in the so-called Western world?
Right. Well, and that's always the big question. So Macron in France has been like the leader in talking about alternative deterrence options. So when he first came to office, he gave a heavily touted speech on nuclear deterrence. And there's a real question. Was he going to offer something as an alternative to the United States for European security? This debate goes all the way back to Charles de Gaulle when he took office, 58 to 66, when he pulled out of the NATO military command. The idea that there would be a French alternative because France really saw the U.S. nuclear guarantee as a form of domination of the security policy discussion in Europe. And so if there could be a French alternative. But the problem is France always sees nuclear weapons as the sole purview of the president of France. No one else can make decisions. So when NATO created a committee to discuss nuclear use, they said, well, no, the president's the only one who's authorized to discuss nuclear employment. So they refused to join. So when Macron made his big speech, the question was he going to change? And of course, the first thing that Germans did was they went to Paris and said, does this mean you're going to give us a veto? Absolutely no. Are you going to give us targeting? No. But we will defend you. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, the whole point of NATO is that allies have a say in their defense. The nuclear planning group exists at NATO since 1966, because from the introduction of nuclear weapons into NATO to 1966, allies wanted more of a say. So the idea of France saying, we will defend you, but we're not going to tell you how or when, and you have no veto and you have no participation, would be a step backwards. So Macron continues to try to see how much he's willing to do. So now he's doing joint exercises where allies can participate in exercises that kind of look like nuclear strike exercises. Great. But still Germany says, do we have a veto? Do we have a say? And the answer is no. Now, the UK is a different matter. UK and France have great cooperation. The UK just signed a big defense treaty with Germany in many areas of cooperation, but including what's it called, the Kensington Treaty, I think it is. It includes defense cooperation, but it doesn't have as big a nuclear guarantee as some people were maybe hoping for. But that is an avenue that you could see, where the UK and France cooperate, because the UK and France both have sub-launched ballistic missiles, strategic weapons for strategic warfare, for strategic deterrence against Russia. The UK also has air-launched cruise missiles that are nuclear-armed. Now, France sees those as strategic weapons, but the UK could see those as theater weapons. So let's say for the next generation of missiles, the UK and France cooperate. France sees its weapons separate. The UK shares its weapons with NATO allies under a similar arrangement to the United States. And so suddenly there's a NATO air-launched cruise missile. You could base it at the same places that NATO already has these stationed. You have a separate agreement between the UK and Germany based on the Treaty of Friendship that says, you know, we're going to have atomic cooperation and we're going to still stay within the NPT treaty. So Germany doesn't get bombs in peacetime, but Germany can participate in planning and in the extreme case, the delivery of these weapons. Now, I think that would be much more attractive to Germany because it gives Germany a say in the use of nuclear weapons that would be used to defend Germany. That's a very important principle. And France can still be France. That's great. So I think that's a really positive way forward, where Germany and the UK could cooperate based on an existing agreement to increase security and to maintain that German voice, which I think is so politically important for the German people, to say that nuclear weapons aren't going to be used in their name without their say-so. It has to be with their say-so. That's the principle of NATO. And I think the UK could provide something like that with Germany. That's a much better option, by the way, than Germany building the bomb. As you point out, Germany has declared itself a non-nuclear power. They signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, enshrining in legal terms its non-nuclear status. Part of the Unification Treaty says it will not build nuclear weapons ever. So you'd have to rip up a lot of treaties for Germany to build a bomb. Whereas I think another option, with using the existing nuclear powers in NATO, France can't quite get there. Maybe they can change their policy in the future. The UK can get there, but they would need help to get there. I think those are the better possibilities.
But everybody is talking about the importance of that format, the E3, at the moment. Right. So we can only hope that the advisors of anybody working on E3 format, that they are listening to this episode and that they take your advice on board. But one last question on this issue, William. How long would it take for that to be implemented? How long would it take for Germany to be dependent maybe on other European allies but not on the US when it comes to nuclear deterrence?
In defense, time is money. So if the money was there, and there is precedent within NATO, there was a proposal by the UK called the Atlantic Nuclear Force back in the 1960s, where allies would pay in to help the UK maintain its deterrent. So imagine a NATO funding structure where allies could pay in to help the UK expand its nuclear infrastructure and very quickly develop this missile with France. You could be looking at something within 5 years. Because the UK already has the capability to refurbish or to produce new warheads if they need to, but it's very limited. But if they had more money, the technology is not a challenge. It's just a matter of money and willpower. And the UK can't do that within their own budget right now, but could they add? We're talking with the United States. We're talking about 100 B-61 bombs in Europe. Could the UK refurbish, repurpose 100 warheads for NATO in a really short, very relatively short period of time? I think the answer is absolutely yes. So if something catastrophic happens with the United States, then I think this is something that should be a priority. Even if not, this provides a belt and braces approach to deterrence. It provides the Europeans with something that they can do in parallel, or instead of, but hopefully in parallel with the United States, so that when, as might happen tomorrow, let's say a war breaks out in Asia and the United States needs its nuclear assets there and they need the B-61s there, wouldn't it be nice for the Europeans to say, it's okay, we've got your back, you go ahead, we have enough intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, we have nuclear warheads, we have delivery systems, we can deter ourselves, we want you back, but go ahead and do it. Because that's what I think the people in the United States who want to totally pivot to Asia see, this total dependence by Europe in so many areas. Whereas if you can provide in the nuclear sphere, in the conventional sphere, in all these spheres, an offset so the United States isn't the sole provider, but is one of the most important partners, then I think that makes that future-proofs the alliance against further ructions in history. Because let's face it, this sort of thing has happened before. You remember with the Vietnam War, the United States was furious that the Europeans wouldn't get involved. They're furious that NATO wouldn't go in. And they wouldn't, because it wasn't in Europeans' interest. That's fine. But that caused a huge ruction within the alliance. Mm. This will happen again. So I think safeguarding the alliance in this way is a reasonable, rational way within law to make sure that Europe is secure against further disruptions in the transatlantic alliance. I hope they don't happen, and I hope this does recede very quickly, but I think the Europeans have to take this very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And the
I have one question, Nina, if I can
jump in.
Here. So we experience here in the United States what happens if you have a different person in the White House than ever before. We see in France and Great Britain also political powers who might have a very different idea from what you just explained so interestingly, William. So this is really a perspective, so to speak, from outside Europe with the experience with Donald Trump in the White House. You know, is this really something we Germans should build our hope on, our future on? Like, how much can we prepare for major political shifts in France and in Great Britain, which might be just around the corner?
Isn't the question also, Ines, do our allies not also say the same about political tendencies here in Germany? You know, if we're looking at the success of some of the fringes, the political fringes, they might ask themselves, really, what if they end up voting for an extreme party? So I absolutely share that thought, Ines, but I do believe that there is no one good answer for as long as we've got concepts like the European Union. You know, the Europeans have to make up their minds just how to decrease their dependency on the US in those vital fields and how to diversify. But the European Union is a fundamentally strong union of countries, of like-minded countries. I want to ask you, Ines, about the American soldiers in Europe, because William just said, you know, it's very likely that America is probably going to eventually pull away some here from Europe. But that always gives us the impression that they're here to make sure that we're all safe and that we can then afford cheap health care because we don't have to care and spend lots of money on our own defense, when really American soldiers are also here to launch operations in the Middle East that the Americans themselves are interested in. So, Ines, if you could just maybe help me get this thought across that there is a lot. Germany and Europe do hold cards, right? Also in terms of defense, what are the cards that you would say Germany needs to put into the window more?
I mean, you just explained it, right? There are major, very strategically highly important operations being led in Germany. And then, of course, also the wounded soldiers being flown in. That's something many kind of American families have experienced, that Germany plays a major role here. But Nina, the problem is when it comes to the public discourse, Donald Trump has really kind of taken this understanding away and is dominating the discourse with exactly what you said. Germany and Europe, they have great schools, they don't pay anything, they have great streets, they have everything cheap for the average people because we pay for them. And this is kind of, this is what most of Americans believe now. They don't, I mean, if you talk, of course, to military experts, they would totally agree that the United States needs Germany also for their own security and safety reasons. But the average Americans don't see that anymore, especially as Donald Trump also says, you know, I'm a peacemaker. I stopped so many wars. I want us to be less involved in other countries militarily wise. So Germany in this strategic thinking is becoming even less important. That's, I think, not true. But if you ask the majority of the Americans, they would, I think, go by now with Donald Trump's false claims.
Okay, and there is vocabulary that the German government has come up with to develop a strategy towards China when they say, we don't want decoupling, but we do want de-risking.
Right.
Is that something, William and Ines, I want to ask you to sort of wrap up this episode, that we're going to see in terms of language used towards the Trump administration coming out of German government communications, that we need to de-risk when it comes to Donald Trump?
Well, going back to what Mark Carney said, if you listen really carefully to what he was saying about de-risking and about economic coercion, he could be speaking about China. The Belt and Road Initiative was a direct effort by China to buy countries and to buy their foreign policy and to coerce them. And Russia, with Nord Stream 1 and 2, Russia and China using economic entanglement in order, sort of like a reverse of Willy Brandt tried with his economic engagement with the Soviets, in order to try to coerce outcomes. So in a way, Europe is the one that has many of the cards, actually massive cards in terms of what I spoke about before, in terms of U.S. financial instruments, et cetera. So it's a matter of, I think, Europe very intelligently using that power and using it not knowing Donald Trump, using it not with arrogance or, you know, you're not respecting us or that kind of language, which I don't think is really helpful. But just the quiet exertion of power really gets his attention. And if you do that veiled in compliments, then you really sort of start to get compliance. And so I think the European leaders, and I think Meres has been really good about this, using a much more sophisticated approach to helping steer Trump's policies in the right way and helping direct his attention in useful ways. So I think de-risking Europe's future, sure, but decoupling is not going to work. You really need that deep economic engagement, both in order to influence outcomes, real power, hard power in this world, but also to make sure that the United States understands. I think one of the reasons that Russia has not been a good partner for Donald Trump is because ultimately, when he really gets close to it, and you look at economically what the United States has to benefit from long-term cooperation with Russia, the answer is very, very little. Russia is, you know, basically just selling off its resources. It does not have long-term economic production. It's not a technology innovator. Europe is. So I think the United States realizes, even in that sort of Trumpian, very hard power, real politic approach, that Europe has a lot more to offer. And the more Europe can engage and enmesh with the United States, the higher cost you give the United States for de-entangling from Europe. I think that's the language that Trump really understands. So I think we should maximize that. And also let's remember, George W. Bush wanted to completely pull U.S. forces out of Europe. He talked about old Europe. He and Rumsfeld denigrated Germany. They wanted full pullout. But it was the U.S. military that said, no, actually, just as Innes said, there's a lot of assets in Germany that we can't get anywhere else. There's a lot of bases in Europe that allow the United States to have power projection in a way that it simply couldn't otherwise. And so I think that that's where we need to really speak to the Americans in terms of hard power, in terms of, and I think that's what's going to save the day in Greenland, is Denmark saying, what is it you want that we haven't given you already? Let's give that. Is there more we can give? And in the meantime, make sure that the United States stays engaged in the world, in Europe in particular, so that we can guide them from time to time, so we can make sure that we're working together and not apart.
Ines, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's so interesting, William, to listen to you. I learned so much. Thank you. Wonderful. I found it very interesting that Donald Trump used the word long term when he talked about the NATO agreement. That's not a word he normally uses, you know. So, and you were just referring to that. So I, you know, when I heard that last night, I thought, wow, he must have spoken to different people than he used to speak to.
Yeah.
So that's something we definitely have to watch. I personally think he will leave this whole Greenland threat episode, whatever, weaker than he started it, because he looked very weak.
Yeah.
For those MAGA people who want like this strong bully leader, they probably didn't want any invasion in Greenland, but he, you know, he was talking about it so often, and I will take it and if needed by force. And then he says, well, no, I don't use force. And now I'm having this long-term strategy thought. It's kind of a new, and also you talked about that earlier, Nina, people start talking about his mental health, his health issues, the way he's walking the red carpet there in Switzerland. So we shall see how this plays out. But you asked about China. I think it's very important, of course, to follow his trip to China in April, Donald Trump's trip. There were rumors that he might make a deal with Xi Jinping about Taiwan. As for now, it doesn't look like it, but that's definitely something we have to watch. And then, I mean, having covered Donald Trump since his first election, as for now, it looks like that this, you know, huge threat towards Greenland is from the table. But let's be frank, he could give us a totally different statement on his way back in Air Force One when he talks to journalists. So yes, it might be a little bit more of a hopeful day this morning here, this morning in Washington, than it was yesterday's morning. But I don't know. I really don't know how long it lasts, because with Donald Trump, we can't know. And we shouldn't be too certain that he now really is interested in long-term solutions.
Thank you so much, you two. And it's just a fact that we don't know what the world is going to look like when this episode is coming out in a couple of hours' time. So for today, thank you very much for listening and watching. And do leave us our comments, join the conversation. I hope you learned as much as Enos and I did listening to William. Thank you very much for being here, and
thank you.
Come again. Make sure that you subscribe to our newsletter, and we'll see each other very, very soon for our next episode of Berlin Briefing.